That's Lou Donaldson on alto sax with Musty Rusty, Bill Hardman on trumpet, Grant Green on guitar, Billy Gardner on organ, and Ben Dixon on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, November the 6th, and New Yorkers elected a Clintonite mayor, Bill de Blasio, yesterday, and big money and stumping by the Clintons and President Obama bought another Clintonite, Terry McAuliffe, the gift that will keep on giving. He is Virginia's new governor. We'll be dealing with elections all week next week when the final numbers are in and can be made sense of, but today we take a look at the city of Detroit, which has elected a new mayor. Democrat Mike Duggan's election yesterday as mayor of the city of Detroit makes him the first white mayor of the city in 40 years. Exit polls were showing that African Americans, who comprise 83% of Detroiters, wanted someone they felt could dig the city out of its $18 billion pending bankruptcy, which, if a current court permits it, will be the largest municipal collapse in U.S. history. Chad Livengood is a reporter with the Detroit News. He reports specifically on the Capitol and matters pertaining thereto. He joins us now to discuss the significance of Duggan's election and the latest developments in the court case in which Governor Rick Snyder and Kevin Orr, the emergency city manager appointed by Snyder, are seeking federal approval for filing bankruptcy, a move that Duggan opposes. Hello, Chad. Nice having you with us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Great. Suppose we start with the significance of Duggan's election. How do you read it?
Well, for your listeners to understand some of the context of what had just happened here, on June 19th of this year, Mike Duggan was thrown off the ballot. He had been thrown off by the ballot or denied access to the primary ballot by the Michigan Court of Appeals after one of his mayoral challengers challenged his filing, his residency or requirement filing. He essentially filed his petitions to run for mayor 4 or 5 days early, and thus had not officially lived in the city of Detroit or been a declared resident in the city of Detroit for at least a year. He filed a few days early, and they used it against him to get him bounced off the ballot. On the 19th of June, he abandoned his campaign for mayor. He walked away from it. He went on vacation, and for a week his phone rang, and so a week later he came back out of nowhere and said he was going to run a write-in campaign in the August primary, and people thought it was crazy. I mean, just write-in campaigns in general, whether it's the small town council, the school board, Congress, state house. They're just really, really big uphill battles, and he went ahead and did it. Now, this guy was backed by a lot of big money interests. He had a big super PAC. He ended up, at the end of the day, outspending his opponent 5-1. But he put together a pretty big write-in campaign, and they went so far to use vacant buildings which there are many of them in Detroit, to put up signs about write in Duggan. And about a couple of weeks before the election, some political operatives opposing Duggan found another guy named Mike Duggan, D-U-G-E-O-N, and he spelled D-U-G-G-A-N.
Good old Chicago, Detroit style politics.
Yeah, kind of Chicago style politics. That was the phrase thrown around. They put him up as a write-in candidate to try to confuse people. And at the end of the day, the real Mike Duggan ended up winning the election by, I believe, 15 percentage points or more. It was kind of in dispute for a while. And there was just countless between getting Duggan thrown off the ballot, challenging all the primary. His lawyers have spent more time in court than he did at times on the stump. But at the end of the day, he ended up pulling off a 10 percentage point victory over Benny Napoleon, the Wayne County Sheriff and a former Detroit Police Department chief, and a native Detroiter. I mean, Mike Duggan, again, less than 2 years ago, Mike Duggan lived in Livonia, a suburb of Detroit. Now he's the mayor.
Right. He pulled 55% of the vote as opposed to Napoleon's 45. Napoleon is the African-American in the race, and they both were and are Democrats.
Yeah.
But voter turnout was said to be less than 20%, but still, a win is a win, I guess.
Yeah, a win's a win. I mean, he still won by nearly 14,000 votes. I mean, this wasn't even close at the end of the day, and some of the voter turnout could be the low voter turnout could be attributed to the fact that Detroit is being run by a state appointed emergency manager right now. And democracy is essentially on pause in the city of Detroit for all intents and purposes, while Governor Rick Snyder's emergency manager, Kevin Orr, runs the city, and for a term that will likely end a year from now. And so going forward, you know, that Mike Duggan is going to have to figure out how he's going to have any role, and there's been a suggestion that Mike Duggan, because of his experience as a sort of turnaround expert, he essentially is credited for saving the Detroit Medical Center hospital system in Detroit, where he was most recently the CEO, and he's also credited for bringing back the suburban bus system from the brink, and he worked in county government, and he was a county prosecutor. There's an idea out there that he could be the chief operating officer, essentially, for the city to run some of the day-to-day operations, while Kevin Orr, who's a bankruptcy attorney, focuses on trying to fix the city's bottom line and make some pretty painful decisions in bankruptcy court.
Considering that Detroit is 83% African American, how did the black vote go in this race between Duggan and Napoleon?
I haven't seen a lot of exit polls yet on demographic breakdown. I think that the up front, when Mike Duggan first moved into the city and bought a house and made it clear he was going to run for mayor, I think that, you know, everyone thought, oh, these guys moving into the prestigious Palmer Woods neighborhood, just another, you know, rich liberal, not going to really get down into the neighborhoods of Detroit where the problems are. But this guy did go, you know, block to block and church to church. And it seemed like more and more that race was not an issue, that the city of Detroit has hit rock bottom here, and that Detroiters are sort of been calling out for a while that they want something new. I mean, this is a city that has politically been in turmoil since 2008, when the text message scandal that exposed the then mayor Kwame Kilpatrick's affair with his chief of staff and his, which ultimately brought him down because he was convicted for lying under oath about that that affair in a big whistleblower lawsuit by some police officers, and it's so since then this city has been in political turmoil essentially. Dave Bing came in a special election in 2009. He had some experience. He's a former manufacturing CEO, but so he had some business acumen, and he came in. He's also better known for being a former NBA basketball star, but Mayor Bing still struggled at times to get the city council to cooperate, and the level of dysfunction on the city council in Detroit is kind of hard to describe some days. And so this perfect storm of both, you know, the political dysfunction, the ongoing corruption trials and investigations of the Kilpatrick administration, and then just the continued flight of people from this city. There's an estimated 685,000 people living in Detroit these days, and in 1950 there was 1.8 million. So this city has drained an unprecedented in American history in the amount of number of people out of its borders, and the citizens who are still left here increasingly are saying, look, we don't care who runs the city, we're going to try anybody basically at this point.
So even if Bonzo were to show up and he looks good, we'll take him too.
Just to be fair, they're not all that happy about the emergency manager. I mean, the emergency manager remains wildly unpopular because it looks like Lansing and it looks like frankly the white governor is sending down people to fix problems in a black city. So that element is still there. But when it came to electing this mayor, it seemed that they were using this as an opportunity to say, we're going to pick our leader, not Lansing.
Well, this brings us to the big elephant in the room, and that is, of course, the bankruptcy proceeding. Where do things stand now, legally?
The trial is now 7 days old. It was going on yesterday, and it resumes tomorrow. There's a trial over whether Detroit is eligible for bankruptcy. They have to prove they're insolvent. They have to prove that they want to cut debt. They have to prove that they had proper authorization from Governor Rick Snyder to file for bankruptcy. And the big requirement is they have to prove to the judge in Detroit that they bargained in good faith with their creditors before they filed for bankruptcy. And that is what the trial has been centered on as far as testimony and evidence introduced, as the labor unions and retiree groups are trying to poke holes in the city's story that the city has maintained that the bankruptcy was not a preordained decision. And there's been a lot of testimony and evidence that come forward to kind of call that into question. And so that is where the trial stands. Testimony is expected to try to be wrapped up tomorrow, and possibly closing statements on Friday. At the same time, this bankruptcy has a lot of moving parts. There is an effort underway to get the judge to secure financing, to allow the city to secure some financing while in bankruptcy, because, frankly, the emergency manager, Kevin Orr, with dwindling revenue, he needs some money, some sort of walking around money to get some projects going in the city, because so far the state of Michigan has essentially refused to infuse any additional cash into the city during this time. And then there's other fights going on. There's an effort to try to stop the emergency manager from imposing some pretty drastic cuts and reductions in retiree health insurance plans. And so there's a lot of different fires here going on, and now Mike Duggan's going to be the mayor. It'll be interesting to see whether he tries to get involved in it, or whether he essentially shows up and reports to duty to the emergency manager and see what he wants him to do.
As far as a governor is concerned, there's a central question about the constitutionality of him actually giving the green light for himself for filing bankruptcy and appointing the city manager. How does the bankruptcy court deal with a question that really doesn't belong in that court?
Well, that is a large, a looming question, is about whether a bankruptcy judge can decide on whether a plan of adjustment to cut debt that cuts pensions in violation of Michigan's state constitutional protection of vested pension benefits, whether a bankruptcy judge has the authority to do that. And that is a legal dispute that most observers believe will probably end up in the Supreme Court, because bankruptcy judges, not to demean them, but they're kind of described as the junior varsity squad of judges, because
the junior varsity squad,
because federal district court judges are actually just a step above them. They're actually there's a different designation in the Constitution for a district court judge versus a bankruptcy court judge, even though they sometimes work in the same building. And when you appeal something in bankruptcy, you go right to the district court before you go to your circuit court. This is an overarching issue in this entire bankruptcy is whether pensions are a contractual right or a property right. If it's a contractual right, contracts get wiped out in bankruptcy every day in this country. Property rights don't get wiped out very easily in this country, as we know from eminent domain cases. You'll have a situation where that could go to the U.S. Supreme Court as well. The parties in this case the creditors seem to realize that, look, that there's just only so much money to go around. Clearly the city cannot support its own services. I mean, you've got a city that's just marred with 70,000 vacant buildings and 40,000 plus broken street lights. The level of services, 56 minute response time for police if you get your house broken into. The response time is so slow in Detroit, and the services are so subpar and unacceptable to anybody who has any sort of reasonable expectation of government, that the creditors realize the writing's on the wall here at times, and that they're probably best served to let this case go forward at whatever speed it needs to go forward at, which has been quick, and take it to the next level, take it to the circuit court, and then eventually take it to the Supreme Court, because that's probably where the dogfight's going to be in this thing.
Was Governor Snyder's testimony, and this was also precedent-setting, it was the first time a governor was actually subpoenaed and ordered to show up in court to testify in person, but was his testimony credible?
I would say that yes, it was. The governor was kind of accused of hiding behind attorney-client privilege, but this, for someone who covers this governor every day, not getting a complete thorough answer, getting a bunch of yes no's, I don't recall, I don't know. That's a good question. These are things that people in the press corps in Lansing are pretty used to. So that's not unusual, because he definitely did say I don't recall countless times. But what the governor tried to do was just to come in and essentially to answer questions, and it would have made him look, he wouldn't have looked very good if he tried to fight this, if he tried to fight the testimony, tried to fight his deposition, and try to hide behind executive privilege. It would have raised probably some doubts and questions about his credibility. So he came in and he sent in his state treasurer, and he's also sending in one of his right hand men too to testify tomorrow. So he definitely did not answer a lot of questions at times, but that's the beauty of having a meeting with your attorney in the room. You can claim attorney-client privilege on a lot of things, basically, if it is anything legal related, which some people might think that that's an abuse of the privilege laws, but that's our legal system in this country.
The different unions, like AFSCME and the Auto Workers Union and people representing the pensioners and retirees, I understand now that they have decided to come together. Any sense of what they're doing as a group, yet negotiating individually. I'm not sure I understand what they're doing.
Well, they are working together as a group in some of the legal proceedings. And it's a little complicated because there is a committee that's been set up at the city's request, and that was one of the city's claims of why they needed to go to bankruptcy. Was there's 40 some unions in the city of Detroit. There's three or four and maybe five different retiree associations. There's two different pension funds. The city claims like some 100,000 different creditors between all the different retirees. And one of the complaints from the city was that they couldn't possibly negotiate with all these people. It was impractical. And they had unions telling them, we don't represent retired people from our members, you know, essentially because they're not dues paying, so we're not representing them. And so it was a little chaotic to be at the beginning. I think they've got, especially with this trial, they had to kind of pool resources, pool their legal minds, they did some of their own discovery individually, and they're making some of their own points, but they're definitely not being redundant to the judges, you know, just for the sake of orderly proceedings. They're you know, divvying up the responsibilities among themselves. But you also do see a little bit of jockeying going on about different interests, because look, the police and firefighters in Detroit do not get Social Security. They did not participate in it because of some IRS rules dating back to the 1970s. So they get a little bit better pension than some of the rest. They get an average of $35,000 roughly, and your average city worker who works in the water department or is a bus driver, or that person's getting about $20,000 pension every year. Now we have our share of fat pensions in Detroit too. I mean, I think Benny Napoleon, the guy who just lost the mayoral race, has a pension north of $85,000 a year for his role as a police officer in the department for many years, and the chief. This is an interesting issue that's kind of emerging behind the scenes, is those police and firefighters are going to try to make a case themselves that they ought to get different treatment. If there's going to be cuts to pensions, they ought to get different treatment than the other guys because they don't have anything to fall back on. They don't have $2,000 a month Social Security check to fall back on, and so far all these sides have kind of been together, but then there's other players here. There's bondholders. There's bond insurers. The guys who have essentially will be on the hook for if bondholders get wiped out, they're going to have to pay the bondholders most of what they lose, and so. There's a lot of different competing interests in this whole case. On top of that, there's 500 some people who had pending lawsuits against the city of Detroit at the time of the bankruptcy. So you can see how this is quite messy, and there's a lot of different people with different agendas. But I think the retirees and the unions have kind of, at least on the pension and retirement health insurance issues, they've definitely have bound together because they realize that they need to have a unified voice on that subject.
Everybody I've talked to so far, Chad, has noted the marked absence of the feds, the federal government, the Obama administration in this fight. Do you know something that they don't know?
Well, the Obama administration, this is where, you know, the president, you know, has had to kind of clarify, or the White House at least has had to clarify, when he went around the country last year and said, "I saved Detroit." Well, look, he saved Detroit's automakers, of which only one of them is actually based in Detroit. That's General Motors.
But they're not manufacturing there. That's their headquarters.
Well, there's a couple of plants, but there's not a lot. Yeah, there's only a couple of different plants. General Motors has got a truck plant, and Chrysler's got a plant on the north side, and there's some suppliers, but in the city limits of Detroit, there isn't a lot of car building going on anymore. And I mean, a lot of it's outside the city limits. So when they say they save Detroit, they're talking about metropolitan Detroit. I mean, and that there, you know, there's no doubt about that. That if one or two or three of those car makers had gone out of business, the Metro Detroit region would have been in economic turmoil. So he's had to kind of come back and say, look, I'm talking about the automakers, the broader global automakers that are based in that region. Here's the deal. If they come in and pump in a bailout for the city of Detroit, they're going to have to go bail out the city of Chicago's pension fund and the state of Illinois' pension fund and the California's pension fund. And so, you know, I can see why the White House doesn't want to get involved in bailing out individual pension funds, because, well, frankly, the federal government doesn't have a lot of extra cash sitting around itself these days. So what they have done is they've tried to help and better organize some of the federal grants that Detroit qualifies for. And they've kind of repurposed, re-pooled together about $300 million over several years that they announced about a month ago or so to try to infuse into the city. Some of it was already money that the city had already qualified for, that hadn't spent. One of the problems in Detroit's bureaucracy for years, they'd get $5 million from HUD to do low-income housing, and they'd have a hard time spending it. There was just mismanagement and the inability to just perform basic municipal services at times, that there was money that just got left on the table. And so the feds have kind of done a look back and grabbed some of that and put it all together and wrapped it in a bow, and the Attorney General came here and delivered it a couple weeks ago. So, but that's been essentially the federal involvement at this point.
Why is this case, I'm asking you as a newsman, why is this case not really in the public domain nationally?
Well, I don't think it's quite. I mean, once the city presumably is going to be granted eligibility, all signs are pointing that way. So once the case is firmly in the bankruptcy court, then there will be the real hard choices to come about how do we pare down $18.5 billion of debt, $11.5 billion of which is unsecured. And that's where you'll probably start seeing, you know, I interviewed this one couple that were both retired cops. I mean, imagine what life's gonna be like for them if their pension is reduced to 20-25% of what they were promised, and how they're going to live. I think when those stories start emerging, and they will emerge next year when the election for the governor is in full swing, I think that'll get a little more of a face on it, and it will start to draw a little more attention to the case. The other thing is, it's hard for the general public on municipal debt to even. A lot of that just kind of goes right over their heads, that's the truth at times, but they don't really realize they will start to realize, at least in Michigan, that if they are able to cut tax unlimited general obligation bonds, which are supposed to be backed by the full faith and credit of the city of Detroit, under the belief that Detroit will just raise taxes to pay that debt. If they are successful in cutting those bonds, then there is a potential out there that this nation's $3.7 trillion municipal bond market that finances everything from new schools to sidewalks and sewers and water towers in this country, that the bond markets are going to react with adding premiums to bonds sold in Michigan, because there's no guarantee that a Michigan municipality, whether it's Marquette or Pontiac or Detroit or Ann Arbor, is going to always pay the bill. So there's potential for impact. I mean, people in West Michigan always say that, you know, nothing that goes on in Detroit affects me. Well, if that happens and the municipal bond markets decide to penalize the, you know, Grand Rapids for Detroit's decision to walk away from its debt, that'll start raising up the price of borrowing and meaning less money to repair the school or the water department or whatever. Those kind of things don't. A lot of people just don't see that kind of stuff on daily day. But I think the pension thing will resonate nationally, especially if it looks like, you know, other municipalities decide to try to follow suit. Because if Detroit is successful in being able to essentially use bankruptcy law and the supremacy clause of the U.S. Constitution to trump a state constitutional protection of pensions, then you know, it would seem that all bets are off and it's going to be tried somewhere else in the country.
Do you see the situation confronting Detroit now as something of a test case on many levels, that people are using this experience, this particular experience, as a way of seeing how far they can push in other cities that are similarly situated? You mentioned Chicago, which is one. Oakland has been mentioned. Washington, D.C. has been mentioned. Philadelphia and so forth. Do you think Detroit is serving as a test case?
Yeah, and some of the creditors are trying to actually make this part of their case against Detroit being eligible. They've thrown out some scant evidence to suggest that Jones Day, the law firm that is Detroit's bankruptcy counsel, it's a global law firm with offices in other countries, but Atlanta and Cleveland and Chicago and L.A. and D.C., that Jones Day is essentially trying to use Detroit as a test case. There's an attorney who wrote a law review article in 2011 sort of opining about how they could use Chapter 9 to alleviate pension liabilities for cities. And that's kind of where that speculation was born. There's a lot of talk about that, and there is some truth to that. That there is people who are watching this closely. That's why you see the AFSCME and the UAW national organizations spending money with some big hired gun attorneys out of New York to try to fight this case. They've got members in Detroit, no doubt, but they also see that this is a new shot at their bow, basically.
Well, and as you mentioned, Jones Day, you know, it would be important to point out that Kevin Orr, the appointed city manager, was a partner at Jones Day, and the governor, Snyder, has hired Jones Day to restructure the city's finances. Has the phrase conflict of interest surfaced yet?
It has, and this has also been brought out in the trial too about Kevin Orr actually came to like the first pitch meeting in Detroit on January 28th of this year to pitch Jones Day's services as restructuring counsel. This is before, you know, the little term they use to say, we're not here taking the bankruptcy, we're here to restructure your finances, which can be done out of court with settlements and stuff. But at that meeting, one of Governor Snyder's aides spotted Kevin Orr and thought he could maybe do this job, and so he approached him and asked if he would, you know, consider walking away from his lucrative, likely multi-million dollar partnership at Jones Day and become the $275,000 a year emergency manager. And that's kind of where that courtship began. And then Jones Day got awarded the contract just before Kevin Orr got hired. Yes, there's a very obvious path to follow there that that Jones Day and Kevin Orr came together. And when Kevin Orr came here on his first day, day after he got appointed, I remember interviewing him, and he essentially was laying out the rules of engagement to the creditors to say that, look, if you don't negotiate with me, his words were, I've got guns. And he was referring to the Jones Day, bench that is quite deep, and they have definitely shown that in court to date. I mean, they're showing up. I think I've lost track how many Jones Day attorneys have been in court to fight this case for them.
I was reading somewhere that the expenses so far, the legal expenses so far, almost almost rival the debt of this city. Let me ask you, as we close out the segment, Chad, you are thinking that it is pointing toward bankruptcy. That's your reading of it. And therefore, what should Detroiters be prepared for?
Well, I mean, Detroiters should be prepared that this bankruptcy is going to go forward, and it will cost a lot of money to do. I mean, there's the city is paying for not only its own attorneys, they're paying for the retiree committee's attorneys and other professionals. So the city is some estimates believe that the city could end up shelling out $200 million to the lawyers, and anybody knows anything about that game knows that the lawyers always get paid first. But Detroiters ought to expect that this is going to happen, and that there is going to be some major tough decisions. One thing we haven't even gotten into is Detroit has a multi-billion dollar art collection sitting over on Woodward Avenue, many of the pieces are owned wholly by the city of Detroit, bought during the 20s and the 40s and 50s during Detroit's heyday of manufacturing when the city was one of the most wealthiest in the country. And this is a big, huge moral dilemma in this case. Do you sell off these cultural treasures to pay pensioners, or do you make pensioners to take away their livelihood in their golden years to preserve the art? There are a lot of wide and varying opinions about that in the city of Detroit these days, and there's no doubt this is going to be a contentious battle all the way to the end.
Well, you have certainly given us a very good tour, a great detailed tour of the inside the courtroom view of what is confronting Detroit as it fights for and against, depending on which side you are on the bankruptcy question. Thank you so much, Chad, and we'll talk again real soon. Thank you so much. All right. That was Chad Liefengood of the Detroit News. We go now to New Mexico for this next story, where on January the 2nd, police followed motorist David Eckert and pulled him over for allegedly not coming to a full stop upon exiting a Walmart parking lot in Deming, New Mexico. Then began an absolute nightmare for Mr. Eckert. He was pulled over, he was patted down, his car was seized, they brought dogs to sniff around, he was forced to submit to 3 enemas, he was forced to defecate in front of police officers and medical personnel and watch them search his stool. He was forced to submit to a colonoscopy and 2 x-rays. He was forced to endure several cavity searches, all in the name of safety for the public. Shannon Kennedy, Mr. Eckert's attorney, explains his federal lawsuit. She joins us now. Thank you, Ms. Kennedy, for being with us.
Well, this is actually Shannon Kennedy's husband, Joe Kennedy, and we're representing him.
Okay.
We are partners in life and partners in the law firm, and we both represent Mr. Eckert. So I'm here available to you to talk to you about this case.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Could you tell us how this came to be?
Good question. And you may have to go back. You know, the police have been pushing the boundaries of a lot of these issues for years and have been stopping motorists, particularly along the border areas, and becoming more and more invasive and more intrusive, and using dogs that aren't certified, that aren't well-trained, and subject to false alerts. So a lot of these things have been going on for a while. And this is the first time I've seen it go this far, though. This is just absolutely outrageous, and so many people failed him along the way. The district attorney was involved in the warrants preparation. A state district court judge, actually signed off on this warrant. Now, the warrant only authorized what would be a visual strip search, including the anal cavity, and then it went way beyond that when the police took him to a second medical facility. The first medical facility refused to do it. They took him to a second medical facility, and that's where all the horror happened.
Did they inform him what it is, why they were doing this, and when they were doing this, was he afforded contact with an attorney or somebody to represent him?
No, absolutely incommunicado. They didn't even call his wife. His wife had no idea where it was. It started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and ended at 3 o'clock in the morning. So they held him incommunicado, did not let him talk to anyone, an attorney, and essentially made jokes on the way to the hospital saying, "We got a, you know, surprise for you." So it was literally terroristic in the sense of how a person in custody who's held incommunicado, who does not know what is going to happen to him, and the emotional effect on that is just devastating.
Have you been able to retrieve any videotape or anything to basically...
They haven't preserved any videotape that we know of, or audio tape. We do have, obviously, the police reports. We will be searching for cell phone numbers and cell phone contacts between the DA and the law enforcement, but we're not at that stage yet. But there is no videotape. We haven't had the videotape of the colonoscopy yet produced to us, but we do have the medical reports and the description of the procedures, and it's stunning. It's one where you don't really believe it happened until you actually read it, that you're somewhat skeptical, but you read the police reports and then you read the medical reports, and it's stunning, almost the antiseptic nature of their analysis, that this is something that's authorized by the search warrant. I'm going to prep him like I normally do for a person who's electively proceeding under this, and then they go forward with it.
I mean, I'm stunned. This case came out of the American Bar Association Journal, so it must have been discussed within the legal community as being a very significant departure from the norm. What precepts or concepts or legal issues does this case raise?
Well, it raises the integrity of the human body. I mean, the Constitution is very clear that there are certain things that we treasure. One is our family, one is our home, our religion, our speech, but also one is our body, our own person. And that's a thing that we've always treasured in this country, the integrity of the body. It's been violated at times, but we have remedies for that, and we have prohibitions against that. So it's the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution that protects our bodies from intrusion by the government, and that's the basis for the lawsuit and why we have rules. The Supreme Court in the 70s had a very familiar case to attorneys where they reviewed the stomach pumping of a man because they believed he swallowed drugs, and the Supreme Court literally said, "We don't like this. We're not going to allow this. This is too close to the screw in the rack." So it's been dealt with squarely with the Supreme Court that medical procedures that are this invasive for this insignificant amount of suspicion of drugs possessions is illegal, outrageous, and not accepted. And this is again, they searched his car, searched him, and found nothing.
Well, this sounds almost, this sounds like it qualifies as a torture case.
It does. It literally does. I mean, he was dumped on his the steps of his home at 4 o'clock in the morning after being transported to the hospital and having this done to him. And it's literally being abducted, held incommunicado, and dumped at your home, at your doorstep when they're finished with you.
What specifically is your client asking?
Well, we're not specifically asking for anything at this point. I mean, at this point, we are asking for this to stop, for him to be vindicated, and we'll get to the point where we sit down and ask about, and we talk about money, but we're not talking to them about this yet. We want to find out more about what's going on behind the scenes, what we don't know, the documents they haven't given us, and are they going to do this to any other people? And our client's very interested in that as well. Once we have those issues resolved, we'll sit down and talk to them about what we want financially.
Well, that sounds like on the civil side, anything being pursued on the criminal side?
No, not at this time. And we anticipate that there may be some interest. We hope that there may be some interest from the federal government to look at this as a civil rights violation on the criminal side, because we certainly think it qualifies. But certainly, well, and this is a situation where you need oversight from the federal government, because the district attorney's office was actually involved in the warrant application, so they're unlikely to prosecute one of their own.
Well, this is what I was really hinting at, a case of prosecutorial misconduct. They had to have known that the instrument that they issued was going to be used in a particular way. Or maybe even afterwards they might have learned that it was in fact used in a particular way that is contrary to what the warrant was for.
Exactly. And it's a loss of perspective, a loss of, the, you know, it's when people get in charge who believe that what they do is so important, that what they need is so important, such as a prosecution of minor drug offenses, that is so important to our community that literally they lose sight of what they're doing in order to, in their minds, enforce the law. And they're forgetting about the law, the big law. The big law is the Constitution. The little laws are the laws outlawing use and possession of drugs. And they forget about that.
By what time should you have an answer or response?
Well, we have had answers and responses formally in the legal process, which is a formal answer, and there is no dispute that he was subjected to these procedures. So they've admitted to it factually.
Is there how would you know when a trial, if any, would be scheduled? Or I'm trying to get a sense of what's the next step in the process.
We're in the initial stages of a federal court litigation, which would be the scheduling conference, and then we'll get a trial setting probably by November. We'll know when the trial is set. In our district in New Mexico, it usually takes about a year to get a civil case to trial, so we anticipate a trial in the fall of 2014.
I checked your homepage, and
yes,
I found a very interesting sentence in describing what your law firm does. And, of course, you said that you're civil rights lawyers and so forth, and your very last sentence in that paragraph says, "We represent victims of police misconduct, including police shootings, wrongful arrests, excessive use of force, illegal searches, and illegal home entries." Now, that would suggest to me, just reading that, that these types of infractions are quite common in your part of the world.
I don't know whether it is or not, you know, because I only live in my part of the world. I do discuss situations with other people across the country, and even in New York. I mean, we all civil libertarian lawyers are mourning the Second Circuit's decision in the stop and frisk case in New York. So that, you know, so when we talk about civil liberties, certainly a stop and frisk is less significant than a colonoscopy, but the thousands and thousands of young men who are being subjected to that in this country is also a significant issue and a significant concern. So So, you know, so this is, you know, this is something that does happen all across the country. We have a certain issue about this on the border area because of the sort of the push towards getting money, frankly, on the forfeiture end of it, and the push to, you know, as relates to drugs. So we have particular issues here, but the whole idea of the loss of personal integrity and the loss of personal privacy, I think, is a universal concern in our country.
Did David Eckert, in your view, fit a particular profile that caused the police to take extraordinary interest in him?
Law enforcement will tell you that there was something about him that they didn't like. Now, whether that was because he was left from a friend's house who they suspected of being a drug dealer, we don't quite know. We don't quite know what caused them to think that he may have had carrying some drugs. But it doesn't. There's nothing about him, certainly nothing about him that would single him out as anyone else other than anyone else that shouldn't be singled out. So it's just one of those things where it was very arbitrary that they decided to do this to this man as opposed to any other person, and just wrong.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Kennedy, for being
You're
with
welcome.
Us today and explaining the particulars of this lawsuit.
You're welcome.
Thank
it was
you.
A pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Well, we're coming to the end of our program today, and I thought that I would just mention a couple of things. The election results aren't quite firm yet, so it will take about another day or two, which means next week we'll be talking elections all week, different aspects of different elections. So we want to be primed for that. I also want to urge you to help us grow PRN.FM and especially Lead Stories. I have to, you know, tout my own little program here. Let's broaden and widen the audience base and get more and more people listening, so we have greater conversations when we do open up on Tuesdays, as we usually do for open forum. And if you listen to the legal questions confronting Detroit today, you see how huge this thing is. This is a major, major case. And it is going to be somewhat calamitous if, in fact, the court gives the green light to the city to go ahead and declare bankruptcy. It will impact all those city workers, pensioners, retirees. It will impact the entire city, the business sector, school system, healthcare delivery, everything in the city of Detroit. But you also heard Chad say that in many ways, Detroit is being used as a test case, and that he meant on the legal front, but we also know that on the political front, on the economic front, on the sociological front, Detroit is a test case. There is no denying that. So I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I hope we learned something. We'll come back to each other tomorrow at the same time. Tell a friend. You can always reach me at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D Stories, @gmail.com, or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. Bye-bye.